Hello and welcome to the June 23rd edition of Juno Afternoon. You're listening to KTOO News. We've got a great show. We'll hear about a concert that's coming up with a 250-member choir and how Love, Inc. is involved with that. We'll chat with representatives from Gustavus about the Gustavus Centennial Celebrations. We'll also get a preview of a special presentation on Morris dancing that's happening tomorrow. And we'll find out about the 52nd Grand Session of the Alaska Assembly of the International Order of the Rainbow. All that and more. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A U.S. Supreme Court ruling last year removing some protections for voting rights prompted Native organizations to ask for a congressional solution, KNBA's Jocelyn Estes reports.
U.S. Senator Mark Begich, a Democrat from Alaska, recently introduced a Native American voting rights bill in Congress. Native American Rights Fund attorney Natalie Landreth says the bill would require states to provide the same voting opportunities to Natives as those available to other state residents.
There are endemic, systemic problems with access to the polls in much of rural Alaska, and indeed these problems are similar on Indian reservations in the lower 48.
Senate Bill 2399 would protect absentee voting, polling places, and provide for Native voters who are not fully proficient in English. Begich says the bill has gained a lot of support in Congress.
We have picked up sponsors from other states around the country because they see this as important to their population also, with American Indians.
The legislation would allow the use of tribal identification cards to vote and provide for federal oversight of certain election changes and tribal consultation. Alaska Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell, who oversees Alaska elections, says the bill is unnecessary and constitutes federal overreach. Senate Bill 2399 is before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
World Cup fever made its way to the Kiowa tribe of Oklahoma Sunday, where more than 100 tribal members gathered to watch the U.S.-Portugal game. They were also showing support for Chris Wondolowski, a Kiowa tribal member and player for the U.S.
I'm a fluent Kiowa speaker. I've been all over the world, but I don't understand soccer.
That's his grandmother, Dorothy Whitehorse Delane.
Having somebody playing in on an international team, and he's from your family, that just overwhelming, because look how far we've come. Kiowas, Bamatan. That means we're always up there. We excel.
Wondolowski plays for the San Jose Earthquakes and was named Most Valuable Player last year. Events were held over the weekend in Canada to celebrate National Aboriginal Day. There were festivals, musical performances, and speeches. The Prime Minister and other leaders, like the Queen's Representative Governor General David Johnson, acknowledged the contributions of the country's Native people.
I know that you will continue to strengthen communities and improve this country, and for that I am truly grateful.
As in many locations, the day began with a sunrise ceremony and a flag raising. This young First Nations girl in Saskatchewan urged all Canadians to participate in events.
I want people to know that it's a lot of fun doing, and like anybody can do it, you know? Like, it's not just Aboriginals who could do it. It could be any culture.
The Canadian government first proclaimed June 21st as National Aboriginal Day in 1996 to recognize First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people. During this week in 2013, Felix Diaz, an indigenous leader in Argentina, met with Catholic Pope Francis and addressed issues like land rights and education. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, with funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
National Native News brings you information from around Indian country and the world. To do this, we rely on financial support from organizations like yours. Find out how to reach our listeners while also supporting this program by visiting nativenews.net.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Hello and welcome back to Juno Afternoon. It's 3:05 p.m. on June 23rd. I'm your Monday host, Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown is in the studio with me. He is the producer and engineer of the show. And the weather is, it says rain, but it's not raining right now. Tonight, rain, lows around 51. Tomorrow, rain likely, and tomorrow night, cloudy. And Wednesday, mostly cloudy, and then it looks like we have mostly cloudy, hovering in the high 50s, even up to 62 on Thursday. All right, we're going to kick off the show with our first set of guests, and we have representatives of Love, Inc. We have Anne Lockhart here, who's the executive director, and Victor Lemer, who is involved with this concert. So the concert is Michael W. Smith, who's a winner of 3 Grammy Awards, 40 Dove Awards, and 13 million albums sold, is coming to Juneau on July 9th with a 250-member choir, and they're playing at Centennial Hall at 5:30, and all proceeds are going toward Love, Inc. So a 250-member choir is like big, big news for Juneau. So, Anne, tell me about this concert and how this came to be.
Okay, I will. So Michael W. Smith is some famous, wonderful Christian musician and has come to Juneau many times, loves it up here, and was coming up on a cruise once again and just wanted to give a concert. And so they contacted Juneau and said, who can coordinate this? And they contacted Love, Inc., since we have like 26 partner churches, and it would be, you know, maybe easier for us to do that. So we said yes, and so here we are with the proceeds for this wonderful concert that they're giving to us, along with a 250-member choir that they will be rehearsing as they cruise the Inside Passage on their way to Juneau.
Sounds fantastic.
I know.
And so it's $10 per ticket, and I understand there's truly like a handful of tickets left. Is that correct?
15 seats left as of midnight.
Last night or this morning.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So there might be.
It might be sold out.
Okay. Yeah. Well, if you're interested to go to this concert, what do they do? Like, they have to move quick, but
so
where do they get
to move quick? And what we've been advised, since Jack is coordinating the ticket sales, they said make sure that you have folks come and get on the waiting list an hour before the show. So the concert's at 5:30. Doors will open at Centennial Hall at 4:30. So people need to come in person and get on that waiting list, sign up, and then we will try to accommodate for those folks that have bought tickets and, you know, won't be able to make it at the last minute.
And what if you want to grab one of those perhaps remaining 15 seats as of midnight last night? How can people get tickets?
Probably the best is to go to Jack, their website, jahc.org, or the bookstores, Heartside or Rainy Day
Retreat.
Yeah. Thank you.
Great. All right. And then question for you, one last thing about the concert. Is there assigned seating, or do people who want to come and get a good seat, they should?
It's festival seating. You get there first. You're going to get up close and personal. Otherwise, it's going to be a U-shaped seating with the stage in the center. And we're working on having video screens set up, so if you are farther back, there'll be a camera getting close-ups, and it'll be a great concert. Very excited. He's done cruises, as Ann mentioned, many times. He loves coming to Juneau. He has a special desire for garlic chicken pizza that's sold downtown. So that's one of his reasons why he likes to come here. So I think in a way, all the pizzas as he put away, he wants to give something back to the community. I don't know if it's been that many pizzas for a free concert, but we'll certainly take that from him. And his timing is perfect. He's done this cruise for years and years. They have several different speakers, musicians on the cruise. People sign up. This is the first year they're doing the choir, but he just came back. He lives in Tennessee with his wife and five kids, and he just got off a worldwide tour of Georgia, but not the state of Georgia, the country of Georgia. He was in Poland recently and Jerusalem, and now I think a cruise is needed for him and his family and 250 choir and everybody else.
It doesn't sound as relaxing as you make it out to be, but I'm sure he'll find some time. And if you want to find out more information about him, you could look him up anywhere, Michael W. Smith. He's got a website. But let's talk about that. That is fantastic, and congratulations. Mm-hmm. That is a big, big fundraiser for Love Inc. Yes. But let's talk about Love Inc. First of all, what does the acronym stand for? And what do you guys do? This is a lot of money, and this is one of your fundraisers.
Right.
So where do the funds go here in our community?
Okay. So Love Inc., Love in the Name of Christ, is a nonprofit organization. And again, there's 26 churches that have joined together, network together so that we can help our neighbors in need. So you don't need to be a member of a church to get any of the help. We have very organized systems set up. We have, like, for example, if somebody came out of jail or came out of the AWARE shelter or other difficult situation and they're literally starting over, we can help them with furniture and with including beds and linens and kitchen dishes and pots and pans, food boxes, cleaning supplies, personal care items, that kind of thing. So we get calls frequently from caseworkers and referrals from the hospital social workers, as well as from pastors and clients themselves that are just have hit a really bad patch in their life, and so we're able to help them that way. We also, for those folks that have called numerous times, we invite them to some of our classes, because we're not just a handout kind of an organization. We also are trying to give them a hand up to really get their feet under them once again. So we've led four different sessions of class series called Jobs for Life for the unemployed and the underemployed, and gotten several referrals from different agencies, state agencies, and it's really been wonderful to see how people do. They have a mentor as well as structured class and homework time and some other classes as well. So
that sounds great. So is the focus of Love Inc. for a restart? Is that what you're talking about?
For
people who have hit a icy patch, whatever cliche we want to use. But your niche is really helping people restart.
Exactly. Yes. And for those people that are struggling to make ends meet, say a single mom who's all alone and, you know, she qualifies for only so much assistance, and we want her to keep working, and so we can help her as she tries to take care of her family. And we're able to mobilize the churches, let them know what the needs are, so they, as well as members of our community, are donating gently used items or brand new items, say couches.
That's
beds,
what I was wondering.
Linen,
so you have
towels.
you kind of have the outreach to say we need this, and then
exactly.
and people are
respond up.
Yeah, incredibly and generous and can say, oh, I could do that. I have something that can work, or so on and so forth. That's great. So is it an office of one?
It is not an office of one. There are several full part-time folks in equivalent to like 2.5 full-time positions. And we work in a clearinghouse, which means phone calls come in and we listen to people's stories and then verify what the need is, and then are able to mobilize our teams that are housed out in the various churches to make deliveries or have folks come to that particular church and pick up the needed items, have transition backpacks too, for folks coming out of prison. Literally, they have what was on their back when they went in, so we're able to have a backpack full of different items, including some vouchers for food and bus tokens and community resources and some clothes. Some of them don't even have clothes.
And that's going to be one of those things that are going to be on display while people are waiting for the concert, is a table showing those backpacks, what goes into it when people leave the prison system, and this is what's given to them.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And another neat thing is called Bags of Love, which is through OCS, Office of Children's Services, kids coming out of their homes and being placed in foster care, maybe in the middle of the night. We have some Girl Scouts that have helped us, and other, you know, Vacation Bible Schools, and whoever wants to, have made pillowcases for little girls or little boys, or, you know, older girls and older boys, and they're full of new pajamas and books and a flashlight and toothbrushes and all kinds of neat things.
That's so terrific.
Yeah.
So if somebody is listening right now, and let's say there's two target audiences here, there's probably more, but there's one that says, oh, wow, that's great. I want to tell Janie or Joe or whatever and let them know that these services are available. And then there's, on the other hand, with, you know, people are going, raising their hands and going, ooh, 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 how can I help? So can we talk about how people could help and how people could get hooked up with these resources?
Sure. So they can call our office at 780-4090. That's the first step. They can also check online at loveinc.org, lovinkjuno.org. So those are the two best ways to do it.
And I'm assuming that along with the actual donations of gently used furniture, a wide variety of things, you also take cash.
We certainly do.
Donations. Okay.
We'll not turn that down.
Okay. And speaking of which, there is a huge fundraiser. One more time, I don't know if people might just be joining us. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Love, Inc. is hosting a concert by Michael W. Smith with a 250-member choir on July 9th. It's a fundraiser. All proceeds are going to Love, Inc. $10 per ticket, with maybe a handful of tickets left. And we're going to take a... go right to his music right now. Listen to a little bit of his music. And thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you
for having us.
Lord, you lead me with the cloud of day, and in the night, the glow of burning flame, and everywhere I go.
Okay, that was Michael W. Smith. He's doing a concert July 9th for Love, Inc. at Centennial Hall. Next up, we're going to listen to a story about Gustavus, which is celebrating its centennial. And this story is by KTOO News personnel, Lisa Fu.
In the summer of 1914, three newlywed couples from Seattle decided to make their way to Southeast Alaska and find some flatlands they'd heard about from a steamship captain.
They were three couples that were friends that were looking for an adventure.
That's Linda Parker, co-founder of Gustavus Historical Archives and Antiquities.
Homesteading was becoming the thing to do, and they thought maybe they'd come up here and see what it was like, see if they could farm and make a living. The little voices of Alaska were calling them, and they came.
Parker's organization is sponsoring the Gustavus Centennial Celebration. She says the three couples, Vern and Janie Henry, Bill and Margaret Taggart, and John and Bernice Davis, traveled most of the way from Juneau in a hired fishing boat. The final leg of the journey up the Salmon River was in a skiff. Clinkets lived across Icy Strait in Hoonah and had fish camps in the Gustavus area. The three couples lived in tents at first. By fall, they built a log cabin where all three couples lived together. The structure no longer exists, but is still referred to as the honeymooner cabin.
The first winter, with nothing much else to do in a very small cabin, all three ladies got pregnant, and that was a complication that they hadn't foreseen.
Parker says it was tough for the young couples, and homesteading proved more difficult than they expected. The Gustavus of today has lots of trees, and many residents grow vegetable gardens. 100 years ago, Parker says the land had very few trees and was boggy, oftentimes requiring hip boots. The only crop that grew was rutabaga.
That was the big thing back then here in the Southeast was rutabagas. Some of the homesteaders, the old stories, they got tired of rutabagas. It was rutabaga everything. And then they would keep them in their cellars and eat them all winter.
The Taggarts left just after 1 year. The Davises after the second. Vern and Janie Henry stayed the longest. They hoped to make a living selling rutabagas to canneries elsewhere in Southeast. But crop after crop met with catastrophe, and by 1919, the Henrys left. Meanwhile, others arrived, like Abraham Lincoln Parker's family in 1917. They were involved in the gold rush and had lived in Skagway and Douglas. Lee Parker, Linda Parker's husband, is one of the grandchildren. The Parker homestead was on Good River.
Quite large, two-story home, many outbuildings, barns, sawmill, a second or third cabin on the property, and they had some horses to pull wagons and things, but they decided to do some cattle, and they did that for their own meat and milk, and also they butchered and sent the meat out to the various canneries that were around.
Back then, the area was called Strawberry Point for its fields of wild strawberries. The name was changed to Gustavus in 1925, but many residents still call it Strawberry Point. Parker says the homesteaders who stuck it out had an independent spirit.
Many of them were looking for ways to be off on their own and pioneer a place that didn't have a government looking over their shoulder for everything, and they liked the isolation and freedom.
Local government only came in 2004 when Gustavus was incorporated as a city. Paul Berry is a former mayor and city council member and is the current manager of the city's disposal and recycling center. Since incorporation, Berry says the independent spirit of residents has only gotten stronger. He calls himself a city apologist.
It's been difficult. I have friends that, you know, don't really want the city, and, you know, they didn't see it as a positive development, or, you know, it's kind of like, you know, can't we do better?
Besides the disposal center, the city also runs the library, fire department, parts of the boat harbor, and the bulk fuel facility. Gustavus has no local law enforcement. That idea failed an advisory measure in 2012. Berry says people are slowly getting used to the idea of Gustavus as a city. While some issues can divide the tight-knit community, it's the community that's kept him around. Berry moved to Gustavus from Fairbanks 30 years ago for the land. He arrived with his brother to build on property they got from a state land lottery.
It's a cool place. It's a cool thing to be a part of. I like that sense of community. You know, some of my customers at the recycling center, I was landfilling their diapers, and you know, now they've got kids. And to be a part of that is, you know, it's a one-shot deal.
The first three couples that arrived in Gustavus didn't end up staying, but they paved the way for many others who did. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Hello, you're listening to Juno Afternoon. It's 3:24 p.m. I'm in the studio with Jeff Brown, who's the producer and engineer of the show. I'm Joan Pardis. Our next guest is from Seattle. His name is Peter Contristano. I did it during the break. And he's here to talk about an English Morris dance performance that's going to happen tomorrow, June 24th, at Marine Park from 9:30 to 10:30. People are getting off the motor vehicle Kennicott, the ferry Kennicott, and they're doing an Alaska Marine Highway road trip, and this is one of their stops. They have four different groups, one from England, Canada, Seattle, and Anchorage, and they'll be performing for about an hour in Marine Park. So, Peter, tell me a little bit about why this is happening and what people can expect.
Sure, Joan. Thanks for having me on your show. This happens to be the 20th anniversary year of Rant and Raven Morris. They're the group that's based in Anchorage. So Morris groups tend to celebrate milestones and have an event called an ale, A-L-E, kind of like the beer. And they Rant and Raven decided, well, let's invite our friends. We'll start this tour down in Bellingham, jump on the ferry, make our way over to Ketchikan, I think was the first stop today, tomorrow Juneau, and then on to Yakutat. And then finally we'll reach Anchorage for the weekend and have a larger celebration there.
Sounds great. So you said Morris dancers like to celebrate big events and tennis, you know, an opportunity to celebrate with a name called, like a beer, ale. Oh. But what is Morris dancing? What is traditional English Morris dancing?
Ah, Jane. Joan. I wish I had the answer. It's so shrouded in mystery.
Morris
dance, yes. But I can tell you this. Here's what we know. We know that back in the 1400s, there are records actually of Morris dancing. From England. It's a traditional dance that originated there. There's some conjecture that perhaps it was tied to the dances of the Moors. The English were sailors and got around and kind of saw this performance in probably Spain and Portugal and brought back these ideas of colorful costumes with bells on the legs and turned this into a dance that initially was a dance that was performed for the court. So the king's court would see Morris dancers come out and entertain. Shakespeare wrote of Morris dancers in the 1500s. By then, they were well established, as part of English culture. As we get into the 1600s, Oliver Cromwell comes in and the Puritans and kind of squelched all of Morris dancing and maypole activity for a bit until the next king came on board. And then there was a resurgence and more common folk started to get involved in Morris dancing into the 1700s and certainly into the 1800s. So, and now we come to today where it's just, it's still an English traditional dance. You'll find Morris dancers in England. Our costumes are kind of like the late 1800s costumes. The group is aging. It used to be during the folk revival of the 60s, there was a lot of interest in Morris and lots of groups started, but now it's kind of a hard sell, unfortunately. But we're keeping the tradition going. We'll be here tomorrow, and I'm hoping folks will come out and see what it's all about.
Okay, so is it similar to Highland dancing or
dancing, right,
or square dancing, which was an American phenomenon, I would imagine?
true. Well, it is, we call it ritual dance.
Okay.
So ritual meaning we're celebrating like the arrival of summer. In the Celtic calendar, May 1st is the start of summer. So Morris dancers traditionally will come out at sunrise and welcome summer. You'll find them at village fetes. Fete, F-E-T-E, is like a little fair, a festival. That's common in England. It happens there. And just in England especially, there's lots of small villages. The Morris groups of that area will kind of gather at those pubs in the village and dance outside, entertain the locals there, have a few beers, sing some songs, play some music, things like that. So this dance, as they perform it, is typically, it can range from eight to as few as one or two dancers. So the set of eight, six or eight is more common, would be a rectangular shape, three or four on each side. There'd be, one or two musicians, and then often these other extraneous characters, the fool and the beast. And I happen to be the fool. For my group, the fool's role is to be part of the dance at times, but also doing things with the audience. So we're that connection. Otherwise, it'd look pretty boring to just sit there as an audience member and see a bunch of guys or girls dancing and then that was it, some music and off they go. So we kind of liven things up, the fool as well as the beast. The beast has that similar role where the beast is inside the dance and then often off doing things with the audience as well.
Wow. So is it like a story?
Well, you know, you could be imaginative, I guess, and look at it that way. But it is really to, you know, it's more of a celebration. You know, it's there, as I mentioned earlier, to celebrate that arrival of summer. And we have handkerchiefs on our hands or sticks, one or the other, bells on our legs. There's lots of leaping in the air. Great music that goes along with it as well. The dances are typically 3 to 5 minutes each. Figures are done with a pair of dancers and then a chorus kind of figure that's done with all the dancers. So it's definitely a spectacle to see.
It sounds great. It sounds great. So you said musicians. What kind of musicians are accompanying the dance?
Well, traditionally for Morris, actually when it originally started, it was more of a pipe and tabor style of music. So a pipe being just a cylinder, three-hole pipe is very common. That musician would hold the pipe in his hand, his right hand, use the three fingers to play it, but then also hang a little tabor drum, we call it. It's kind of like a little tambourine-shaped drum. Just hang that from your pinky, and then use the other free left hand to strike that drum to keep a beat going. And then, you know, as instruments became more common, like the violin, the fiddle, and then, you know, into the 1500s, 1600s, and then we have in the 1700s and 1800s, more in the 1800s, the introduction of the concertina, right? That's basically a harmonica in a box. And then later in the 1800s, we have the button accordion, which is very common. So for our groups that will be here tomorrow, I think you'll actually see all of those instruments. There is a woman that plays the pipe and tabor drum, and we definitely have fiddlers and box players as well.
Wow. So how many? So there's four groups performing. This is hosted by the Juneau Public Library. It's tomorrow at Marine Park from 9:30 to 10:30. Right. How many are in your group, the Canadian group, the Vancouver Morrismen?
Correct, the Vancouver Morrismen. Yeah, we'll have four dancers with us tomorrow, along with one musician. So we'll do our dances in sets of four. Some of our dances will be one- or two-person dances, which we call jigs. That's some of the music that Jeff played earlier is actually the introduction to a jig. The other groups that are coming will have same range, 4 to 6 dancers in groups. The other thing I need to tell you, Joan, is about the types or traditions of Morris. This time of year, very common is the Cotswold tradition of Morris. So that comes from the southwestern part of England. If you know where Stonehenge is, kind of north of Stonehenge is Gloucestershire, and just to the east of that is Oxfordshire, where Oxford University is. So those two counties are where there was a lot of sheep farming. You know, these dancers back in the 1700s, 1800s were typically farm workers. You know, and when they had time, they would dress in some colorful costumes and do their practice and be out for these celebrations in May and village fetes as well. So as we get into the year, though, you know, later in the year, what's more common is Welsh border Morris dances. So along the border of Wales, we have Shropshire, Herefordshire, Worcestershire. Those are all in that area. Those dances tend to be done with a more of a like a rag style coat, and you'll see this tomorrow. Actually, the Rant and Raven group, in fact, dances the Welsh border style of Morris, and typically that would come with a blackening of the face just for anonymity. Those workers were farm workers, but at that time of year, there really wasn't any farming work for them. You know, late in the year around the holiday time, so they would blacken up, wear some raggy clothes. Do a little dance or something out in front of the village or pub or, you know, in public and try to raise some money that way. So they would do that. You'll see the group coming from England as well will be doing, I think, a mix of Cotswold as well as Welsh border dances. And the other things around Morris we have, you know, besides these dances I mentioned, there's also plays, Mummer's plays. And that's also typically done at year-end. And it's often a theme of death and resurrection. You know, out goes the current year, and we're preparing for the new year. So it's typically represented by a mock battle between the Turkish knight and St. George, something like that. And the doctor comes in to revive the character that happened to lose that battle. And then there's some other fringe characters that come in and add some more interesting commentary to fill out the play. And they're very short plays. And we'll do one of those, actually, too. The Vancouver men do that.
That sounds terrific. So I have just one I always say one last question, but I usually have a few more. But one question is, so did you get interested in Morris dancing because of the dancing, or you're an Anglophile? Which one, or both?
Well, yeah, is my story simple? I don't know. I'll tell you this. I'm actually from New Hampshire originally, and in New England, contra dance is very common, and I think you actually have a contra dance here, too, in Juneau.
We do. We have a vibrant contra dance community.
Yeah, now that kind of...
and Highland dance as
well. And Highland dance as well, good. So contra dance is more of a social, you know, type of dance, but it's usually, I should say, at least in New England, it's a subset of that community that takes interest in the ritual dances, these display dances that I mentioned. So I kind of went down that path, but then I was fortunate to have an assignment overseas in England for 5 years. So I danced there with the Winchester Morris Men during that time, and met with other groups and learned other traditions, some sword dancing, which also falls under Morris, the mummers, as I mentioned, and then these different styles of Morris there. So I had that opportunity, came back to America, made my way back to North Carolina and started a group there in Asheville, the Asheville Morris Men. They're still active today, and then eventually made it to the Northwest where I found the Vancouver Men.
That sounds great. So tomorrow, 9:30 to 10:30, Marine Park, sounds like a great show for 1 hour, many different groups, many different dances and music and little plays and fools and beasts weaving their way around the crowd. And then I assume that you will be boarding the ship and going up north?
We will. Off to Yakutat to actually meet with, I think, a Native American group there.
Yeah, great.
To dance with them and then on our way north. I do have this one thing to say, though, that my our organizer had mentioned, I should say, that this particular event is sponsored by the Celtic community of Alaska.
Mm.
It's also made possible with funding by the Rasmussen Foundation through the Harper Arts Touring Fund, which is administered under contract by the Alaska State Council on the Arts.
That's great. That was wonderful. Thank you so much for coming in today.
All right, Jen.
Tomorrow, 9:30 to 10:30, Marine Park. Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 23rd of June, 2014. Tonight is Midsummer Night's Eve, St. John's Eve, St. John the patron saint of beekeepers, a time when the hives are full of honey. The full moon this month was called the Mead Moon because honey was fermented to make mead, and that's where the word honeymoon comes from. It's a time for lovers. An old Swedish proverb says, "Midsummer night is not long, but it sets many cradles rocking." Shakespeare set his play A Midsummer Night's Dream on this night. Two young couples who wander into a magical forest outside Athens. In the play, Shakespeare wrote, "The course of true love never did run smooth." It was on this day, 1972, that Title IX was signed into law by President Richard Nixon. Title IX, which prohibited sex discrimination in any federally funded education activity or program, applying to all schools, elementary to universities, public and private. And though the original language of Title IX did not mention sports, the biggest effect of the law came for female athletes in high school and college, whose opportunities before had been very, very limited. Title IX was introduced in the House by Representative Edith Green of Oregon, the chair of the House Committee on Education, and she encouraged women's groups and other supporters to stay quiet on the issue, hoping that Congress wouldn't think too hard about the significance of Title IX and just vote for it, and that is pretty much what happened. Somebody raised a brief concern that Title IX would require schools to allow women to play football, but nonetheless the bill was passed, and it revolutionized gender equity in education. Since it passed in 1972, the percentage of women getting degrees in higher education has steadily climbed. Women now outpace men in obtaining both bachelor's and graduate degrees. After the passage of Title IX, women's teams were required to have the same resources as men's teams. Spending had to be proportional to the number of athletes participating. At the high school level, girls' participation in sports has increased by more than 900% since 1972. And it was on this day in 1868 the first typewriter was patented by Christopher Latham Sholes. It took up about as much room as a large table, but Mark Twain bought one almost as soon as they came out. And in 1883, he sent the manuscript of his book Life on the Mississippi to his publisher in typed form. He was the first author ever to do so. Here's a poem for today by William Stafford, Old Blue. Someday I'll crank up that Corvette, let it mumble those marvelous oil-swimming gears and speak its authority. I'll rock its big wheels till they roll free onto the drive. Nobody can stop us then. Loaded with everything, we'll pick up momentum for the hill north of town. Mona, you didn't value me, and it's too late now. Steve, remember your refusal to go along on those deals when you all opposed me? You had your chance. Goodbye, you squealers and grubbies. Goodbye, old house that begins to leak. Neighbors gone stodgy. Days that lean casually, grunting and snoring together. For anyone who ever needs the person they slighted, this is my address. Gone. Poem by William Stafford, Old Blue, from The Way It Is, New and Selected Poems, published by Gray Wolf Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The clinic is closed and you or a loved one don't feel well, or you have a health-related question that can't wait. What do you do? Here's the solution. Starting July 1st, Search will have a free after-hours nurse triage line for our patients in Juneau. Search's free after-hours service is available by calling 1-800-613-0560. For life-threatening emergencies, please call 911.
This message brought to you by Search, your partner in health.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. It's 3:42 p.m. You are listening to KTOO. I'm Joan Pardis, your Monday host. Jeff Brown is in the studio. He is the producer and engineer of the show. And we have representatives of the International Order of the Rainbow. And we have Gabrielle and Sorsha. Sorsha is the state president. She's 20 years old. Gabrielle is a state advisor, an adult state advisor, even though I guess Sorsha is an adult as well. And they're here to talk about the 52nd Grand Session of the Alaska Grand Assembly of the International Order of the Rainbow that's happening now until the 26th. And more than 70 young women from across the state are coming to Juneau to be a part of this. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Sorsha's wearing a beautiful purple dress and a great owl mascot, which I understand is the mascot of the year. Mm-hmm. But before we get into that, I'd like to start at the very beginning because I don't know much about the International Order of the Rainbow. So can you Tell me a little bit about what a Rainbow Girl is and what the organization's goals are.
Mm-hmm. The International Order of the Rainbow for Girls is a youth service organization for girls ages 11 to 20, and we do a lot of skill building, like event planning and confidence in public speaking, speech writing, and we do a lot of focusing on service to other groups in the community around the state, around the U.S., and around the world.
Wow, that sounds great. So do you meet weekly, monthly?
We have required meetings once a month, but most often the girls will meet twice a month. And so in Juneau, we meet on Saturdays. In Anchorage, they meet on Wednesdays. And Fairbanks, they meet on Mondays. It just depends on what works for the girls' schedules.
Okay. And so when you talk about working with other service organizations and event planning, can you be specific? Like, give me some examples.
Today we were out at Super Bear working with the Southeast Alaska Food Bank on a food drive that we did this afternoon.
Great.
We've done various other projects. What else have
we done? We've worked at the Glory Hole in either gaining items that they need or making blankets or raising funds. We really believe in hands-on service. The girls learn a lot about working with people who are different than them. And so we really like the hands-on service. But we also raise money for wonderful causes. Each president, local and state, comes with their own service project that means a lot to them, that they can really care about. And then they just dive in, and they just do a fantastic job. But everything from Glory Hole, the Shriners, we do a lot with the Shriners, raising money for their mileage program that helps Alaskan kids get to the Shriners Hospital in Oregon. And anything that the girls really care about, we help support them.
We looked at fundraising for Parkinson's research and AIDS research last year. Those were two of our state projects.
And you're the state president this year, so yes. Your passion was hunger.
We worked with the Scottish Rite Care this year, which is a branch similar to the Shriners, and we looked at hard of hearing and deaf organizations and how we could assist them and teaching the girls various things that they may not know about the deaf community and how they're different, but they're similar. And so it was supposed to be, you know, a growth experience for the girls to learn how to deal with this specific group of people.
Oh, interesting. So what is, I see that Sorsha has a very beautiful owl necklace on, and her mom has owl earrings on. So what's the significance of the owl?
Each president, both local, state, and our international president, picks themes and term items that, you know, more express who you are and gives you something you can decorate various events and stuff like that. And so my mascot this year was the owl, and so I've gotten lots of different owl gifts, and I send out owl cards, and each president picks their own.
And is there a reason for the owl?
Why you pick like owls, okay. And I would not mind if I got a million of them. So,
so it's a perfect opportunity to share your interests. That sounds good. So in Juneau, there are 15 young women involved with the organization, 70 throughout the state. It's obviously nationwide, international, so on and so forth. So what happens at the 52nd Grand Session of the Alaska Grand Assembly of the Rainbow Girls?
Well, this is our state convention, so our state officers get the chance. We don't, because the state's so big, we don't get to see each other a whole lot. And so our state convention is the one time of the year where we can all get together, and we get to go through the various ceremonies that our organization has, and they get to show off a little bit, and then we'll pick the new officers for next year.
And do they have to be as old as you are? Do they have to be 20?
They do not. We have... you just have to have been a past local president in your own city, and then you can have the potential to receive the appointment of a state office.
Okay. And then if people are interested to participate in this Grand Assembly, there's two public ceremonies. There's one tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, and that's the grand opening ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's one Thursday at 3:30 where the new officers are picked.
Yep.
Okay. So I have a question for both of you. So Gabrielle, Sorsha, how long have you been involved with the Rainbow?
I joined the organization officially when I was 11 at mm-hmm. the state convention when it was held at DZ in 2005. My mother and my grandmother are both past Rainbow Girls in Juneau, and so I have been attending events since I was born.
Okay. And if you could identify one thing that you feel that you learned directly from this experience. Is there one thing that, or two things?
I don't know if there's, you know, there's, it's hard to sum up, you know, this is my ninth year of
well,
experience.
Well, your whole life, actually.
I've much better at speech writing. I can, you know, they do all sorts of speeches in schools, and I never had a problem with those because I have to do them all the time. And I learn things that other people have, or Book of Ceremonies. I have to learn things that were written in 1922 in the language of the day and figure out how to make that mean something today. And so it's a lot of different skills that you don't necessarily get all the time. And so Rainbow Girls are the people who are first to give speeches. I can manage this.
It's a great skill. It's a great skill. And what about you?
Well, as a state adult advisor, I have to look at the two-prong approach that we have. The girls come to this looking for fun. They find they're invited by a friend to attend a slumber party or to make fleece blankets for the glory hole, and they just walk out of there saying that they had fun. As a parent and as an advisor, I look at that and say how much the girls learned in organizing that event, how much they planned in planning a budget, in working with people who are vastly different. And they are the girls themselves come from different places, and they form a sisterhood to do better in their community and gain character. And it's wonderful to watch her grow up. It's wonderful that the previous presidents that I've worked with, I've worked with six now, each one is an amazing woman going out into the world now, and we've prepared her to be just fantastic and watch them grow.
That's great. So if people are interested to learn more, are there resources online that they could
check
out?
We have our international website is gorainbow.org. It covers the entire world of Rainbow, and we have a jurisdictional site for faces that you may recognize in the state of Alaska at akiorg.org. You know, we have policy protections for our girls, but the pictures are fabulous. It gives wonderful history and the activities that they're working on, and we'll give contacts for the three towns in each place, too, who can be called.
That sounds great. And that's Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau?
Yes, mm-hmm. Right now. We used to have 18 towns and assemblies in the state of Alaska, and, you know, due to dwindling organizational things, we're a little bit smaller, but Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau.
Sounds great. Okay, so if you want to find out more, that's the way to do it, and you could also go to the public ceremony, 7 p.m. tomorrow night at the Baranoff, and Thursday at 3:30. Thank you so much for coming in and educating me on the organization.
Thank you so much for having us.
Great. We're going to go to Brenda Hewitt's Mudrooms, and we'll be back right after that, her story from Mudrooms. Okay, thanks again.
Brenda Hewitt arrived in Fairbanks, Alaska on September 1st, 1968. It was the beginning of a love affair with the land and her people that has only grown with time. A volunteer addict, she works as the chief of staff for Representative Doug Isaacson from North Pole, but has held a variety of eclectic jobs ranging from TV weather girl to travel agent, campground manager to the CEO of United Way of Southeast Alaska. She is excited to marry Tony Fuller at Chena Hot Springs Resort next month. She has a passion for literacy, and tonight she has a story to tell.
Thank you very much for accommodating me and letting me go first, because I have a 7:45 plane to catch tonight, and you're letting me go first. You're starting on time, and so I just want to thank you and everybody for letting me take the opportunity this way. Well, you don't get to be 60 years old without having a few close calls, do you? Well, that's my first close call, so I got to catch that flight. The second close call is that Tony almost didn't come to our 40th class reunion. Now, this happened two summers ago, but Tony and I have been dating for almost 3 years, and we're engaged to get married next month. And yes, I'm pretty excited about that. Well, let me explain to you a little bit more about how Tony and I got to meet each other, because we grew up in Fairbanks, and we both went to Lathrop High School, and he did decide to come to his 40th class reunion. Right after the reunion, we started communicating with each other through Facebook, because that was how the class got together, was through the Facebook account. Then we finally worked up to, like, sharing the personal emails. Then we've worked up to phone calls, and then finally, a visit. Even then, it took 3 days before Tony would hold my hand. And I'm telling you this just so you get to know Tony a little bit better. He seems like he'd be this shy, sort of quiet guy to anybody that might be a little unsuspecting. And that's why this story seems even a little bit more unbelievable. Now, Tony has a 240-acre ranch in southern Missouri. I call it a ranch because the only thing on it is beef cattle. That seems like a ranch, right? No, if you live in Missouri, they call it a farm. Fine. Well, anyway, it's a nice little place. He's got a three-bedroom house on there and these great big, huge deciduous trees you can't quite put your arms around. And it's sandwiched somewhere between the Mark Twain Forest and the Ozarks. So there's these nice rolling hills, and really is quite pretty down there. As pretty as it could be for not being Alaska. So I was down there on this nice, warm summer night, and Tony had explained to me that he had just paid off the farm. And he'd been telling people for years that when he paid off the farm, he was going to run naked down Main Street. Yeah, that's the beginning of the story. Now, if you actually look up where Tony lives, he lives in a small town called Kabool, C-A-B-O-O-L. If you look on Wikipedia, you can actually see a picture of Main Street. You'll see the flag flying out in front of City Hall. You'll see the big bank next door. And then you'll see the awning, the little blue awning that goes to the hardware store. And just beyond that is the pharmacy. And my point is it's like a block and a half long. I mean, Kabool's claim to fame is that it's the largest town in the largest county in Missouri. If I tell you that there's only 2,000 people in it, it lets you know that this is really the heartland of America. It's rural, rural America. 2,000 people. That's a tiny place. Anyway, so at 2 o'clock in the morning, I nudged Tony and I said, "Get up. We're going to town." And before he could wake up, he had put on his jeans, threw on a t-shirt, grabbed his tennis shoes, and we got in his 1984 Saab to drive the 5 miles to town. Now, we're laughing all the way to town, but I'm looking to see how much traffic there really is in Kabool, Missouri at 2 o'clock in the morning. And there wasn't much, thankfully. So as we got close to Main Street, we started looking in the cars on either side to make sure there weren't any bodies moving, and it all looked like the coast was clear. So we got down, we parked down by the pharmacy, and as he's getting out of the car and stripping, he looks at me and he goes, "Now you do know how to drive a clutch, right?" "Oh, yeah, no problem. You know, I grew up on a little Volkswagen Bug. I can drive a clutch." Well, what I didn't tell him was that I had never driven a Subaru, a Saab, which is what he drove, and I couldn't even figure out how to move the seat forward. So while he's streaking down the Main Street, I'm still trying to figure out how to get the clutch all the way to the ground. So he turns around and looks and notices that the car is not coming for him. So he turned around and streaked back. He opened up the car door and I promptly moved over and he sat down, and sure enough, as soon as he sat down, there come the police car right around the corner where he had just streaked. The lights on, and I'm thinking, oh, you know, so we sat there really quiet for a minute and it wasn't us. So we drove home and we're laughing the whole way, and I thought to myself, I wonder if the bank has cameras on the outside. So that kept him awake for a few more days and trying to think of, oh my gosh. So he actually went into the bank a few days later and there were no giggles or marriage proposals. So he figured that he was pretty safe. Anyway, thank you.
So that was Brenda Hewitt with her story from Mudrooms, the last Mudrooms that happened in May. If you're hungry for more stories, they'll be airing tonight, KTOO News, tonight on the KTOO station at 7 o'clock. So that Brenda story and other stories will be the broadcast from the latest Mudrooms. They'll be rejoining and retelling their stories, starting up a whole new season come the fall. Okay, the weather. Tonight, rain, patchy fog late, lows around 50, variable wind 10 miles per hour, becoming light in the evening. Tomorrow, patchy fog in the morning and then rain, highs around 60. Tomorrow night, showers. Wednesday, numerous showers. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy. And Thursday, mostly cloudy, highs around 65, lows hovering around 45 to 50 at night. Tomorrow, Juno Afternoon, we'll be chatting with Shona Strasser about Theater in the Wild, another Perseverance Theater product. Jim McCobiak will highlight the history of Gustavus as the community gets ready for their upcoming centennial celebrations. Hava Lee from the Gastineau Humane Society will fill us in on their upcoming open house, and we'll get details about the Southeast Alaska State Fair that happens in Haines at the end of July. Thank you for listening. I'm Joan Pardis, your Monday host. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show. You've been listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News. All Things Considered is next.